4. 2 days ago, while Susanna was skinning out a rabbit and Roland was starting supper, Eddie had been in the forest just south of camp. He had seen a funny spur of wood jutting out of a fresh stump. A weird feeling, he supposed it was the one people called déjà vu, swept over him, and he found himself staring fixedly at the spur, which looked like a badly shaped doorknob. He was distantly aware that his mouth had gone dry. After several seconds, he realized he was looking at the spur sticking out of the stump, but thinking about the courtyard behind the building where he and Henry had lived, thinking about the feel of the warm cement under his ass and the whopping smells of garbage from the dumpster around the corner in the alley. In this memory, he had a chunk of wood in his left hand and a paring knife from the drawer by the sink in his right. The chunk of wood jutting from the stump had called up the memory of that brief period when he had fallen violently in love with wood carving. It was just that the memory was buried so deep he hadn't realized at first what it was. What he had loved most about carving was the seeing part, which happened even before you began. Sometimes you saw a car or a truck, sometimes a dog or cat. Once, he remembered, it had been the face of an idol, one of those spooky Easter Island monoliths he had seen in an issue of National Geographic at school. That had turned out to be a good one. The game was to find out how much of that thing you could get out of the wood without breaking it. You could never get it all, but if you were very careful, you could sometimes get quite a lot. There was something inside the boss on the side of the stump. He thought he might be able to release quite a lot of it with Roland's knife. It was the sharpest, handiest tool he had ever used. Something inside the wood, waiting patiently for someone like him, to come along and let it out, to set it free. "Aw, look at the sissy. What you making today, sissy? A dollhouse? A piss-pot for your itty-bitty teeny-peeny? A slingshot so you can pretend to hunt rabbits just like the big boys? Aw, ain't that cute?" He felt a burst of shame, a sense of wrongness, that strong sense of secrets that must be kept at any cost. And then he remembered, again, that Henry Dean, who had in his later years become the great sage and eminent junkie, was dead. This realization had still not lost its power to surprise. It kept hitting him in different ways, sometimes with sorrow, sometimes with guilt, sometimes with anger. On this day, 2 days before the great bear came charging out of the green corridors of the woods, it had hit him in the most surprising way of all. He had felt relief and a soaring joy. He was free. Eddie had borrowed Roland's knife. He used it to cut carefully around the jutting boss of wood, then brought it back and sat beneath a tree with it, turning it this way and that. He was not looking at it. He was looking into it. Susanna had finished with her rabbit. The meat went into the pot, over the fire, the skin she stretched between two sticks, tying it with hanks of rawhide from Roland's purse. Later on, after the evening meal, Eddie would begin scraping it clean. She used her hands and arms, slipping effortlessly over to where Eddie was sitting with his back propped against the tall old pine. At the campfire, Roland was crumbling some arcane and no doubt delicious woods herb into the pot. "What's doing, Eddie?" Eddie had found himself restraining an absurd urge to hide the boss of wood behind his back.
"Nothing," he said. "Thought I might, you know, carve something."
He paused, then added,
"I'm not very good, though."
He sounded as if he might be trying to reassure her of this fact. She had looked at him, puzzled. For a moment she seemed on the verge of saying something, then simply shrugged and left him alone. She had no idea why Eddie seemed ashamed to be passing a little time in whittling. Her father had done it all the time. But if it was something that needed to be talked about, she supposed Eddie would get to it in his own time. He knew the guilty feelings were stupid and pointless, but he also knew he felt more comfortable doing this work when Roland and Susanna were out of camp. Old habits, it seemed, sometimes died hard. Beating heroin was child's play compared to beating your childhood. When they were away, hunting or shooting or keeping Roland's peculiar form of school, Eddie found himself able to turn to his piece of wood with surprising skill and increasing pleasure. A shape was in there, all right. He had been right about that. It was a simple one, and Roland's knife was setting it free with an eerie ease. Eddie thought he was going to get almost all of it, and that meant the slingshot might actually turn out to be a practical weapon. Not much compared to Roland's big revolvers, maybe, but something he had made himself, just the same. His. And this idea pleased him very much. When the first crows rose in the air, cawing affrightedly, he did not hear. He was already thinking, hoping, that he might see a tree with a bow trapped in it before too long. Five. He heard the bear approaching before Roland and Susanna did, but not much before. He was lost in that high daze of concentration which accompanies the creative impulse at its sweetest and most powerful. He had suppressed these impulses for most of his life, and now this one held him wholly in its grip. Eddie was a willing prisoner. He was pulled from his daze not by the sound of falling trees, but by the rapid thunder of a .45 from the south. He looked up, smiling, and brushed hair from his forehead with a sawdusty hand. In that moment, sitting with his back against a tall pine in the clearing which had become home, his face crisscrossed with opposing beams of green-gold forest light, he looked handsome indeed. A young man with unruly dark hair which constantly tried to spill across his high forehead. A young man with a strong, mobile mouth and hazel eyes. For a moment his eyes shifted to Roland's other gun, hanging by its belt from a nearby branch, and he found himself wondering how long it had been since Roland had gone anywhere without at least one of his fabulous weapons hanging by his side. That question led to two others. How old was he, this man who had plucked Eddie and Susanna from their world and their wens? And more important, what was wrong with him? Susanna had promised to broach that subject, if she shot well and didn't get Roland's back hair up, that was. Eddie didn't think Roland would tell her, not at first. But it was time to let old Long Tall and Ugly know that they knew something was wrong. "There'll be water if God wills it," Eddie said. He turned back to his carving with a little smile playing on his lips. They had both begun to pick up Roland's little sayings, and he theirs. It was almost as if they were halves of the same. Then a tree fell close by in the forest, and Eddie was on his feet in a second, the half-carved slingshot in one hand, Roland's knife in the other. He stared across the clearing in the direction of the sound, heart thumping, all his senses finally alert. Something was coming. Now he could hear it, trampling its heedless way through the underbrush, and he marveled bitterly that this realization had come so late. Far back in his mind, a small voice told him this was what he got. This was what he got for doing something better than Henry, for making Henry nervous. Another tree fell with a ratcheting, coughing crash. Looking down a ragged aisle between the tall firs, Eddie saw a cloud of sawdust rise in the still air. The creature responsible for that cloud suddenly bellowed, a raging, gut-freezing sound. It was one huge motherfucker, whatever it was. He dropped the chunk of wood, then flipped Roland's knife at a tree 15 feet to his left. It somersaulted twice in the air, and then stuck halfway to the hilt in the wood, quivering. He grabbed Roland's .45 from the place where it hung and cocked it. Stand or run? But he discovered he no longer had the luxury of that question. The thing was fast as well as huge, and it was now too late to run. A gigantic shape began to disclose itself in that aisle of trees north of the clearing, a shape which towered above all but the tallest trees. It was lumbering directly toward him, and as its eyes fixed upon Eddie Dean, it gave voice to another of those cries. "Oh, man, I'm fucked," Eddie whispered as another tree bent, cracked like a mortar, then crashed to the forest floor in a cloud of dust and dead needles. Now it was lumbering straight toward the clearing where he stood, a bear the size of King Kong. Its footfalls made the ground shake. "What will you do, Eddie?" Roland suddenly asked. "Think. It's the only advantage you have over yon beast. What will you do?" He didn't think he could kill it. Maybe with a bazooka, but probably not with the gunslinger's .45. He could run, but had an idea that the oncoming beast might be pretty fast when it wanted to be. He guessed the chances of ending up as jammed between the Great Bear's toes might be as high as 50-50. So which one was it going to be? Stand here and start shooting, or run like his hair was on fire and his ass was catching? It occurred to him that there was a third choice. He could climb. He turned toward the tree against which he had been leaning. It was a huge, hoary pine, easily the tallest tree in this part of the woods. The first branch spread out over the forest floor in a feathery green fan about 8 feet up. Eddie dropped the revolver's hammer and then jammed the gun into the waistband of his pants. He leaped for the branch, grabbed it, and did a frantic chin-up. Behind him, the bear gave voice to another bellow as it burst into the clearing. The bear would have had him just the same, would have left Eddie Dean's guts hanging in gaudy strings from the lowest branches of the pine, if another of those sneezing fits had not come on it at that moment. It kicked the ashy remains of the campfire into a black cloud and then stood almost doubled over, huge front paws on its huge thighs, looking for a moment like an old man in a fur coat, an old man with a cold. It sneezed again and again, achoo, 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 and clouds of parasites blew out of its muzzle. Hot urine flowed in a stream between its legs and hissed out the campfire's scattered embers. Eddie did not waste the few crucial extra moments he had been given. He went up the tree like a monkey on a stick, pausing only once to make sure the gunslinger's revolver was still seated firmly in the waistband of his pants. He was in terror, already half convinced that he was going to die. What else could he expect now that Henry wasn't around to watch out for him? But a crazy laughter raved through his head just the same. "Been treed," he thought. "How about that, sports fans? Been treed by Bearzilla!" The creature raised its head again, the thing turning between its ears, catching winks and flashes of sunlight as it did so, then charged Eddie's tree. It reached high with one paw and slashed forward, meaning to knock Eddie loose like a pine cone. The paw tore through the branch he was standing on just as he lunged upward to the next. That paw tore through one of his shoes as well, pulling it from his foot and sending it flying in two ragged pieces. "That's okay," Eddie thought. "You can have them both, Brer Bear, if you want. Goddamn things were worn out anyway." The bear roared and lashed at the tree, cutting deep wounds in its ancient bark, wounds which bled clear, resinous sap. Eddie kept on yanking himself up. The branches were thinning now, and when he risked a glance down, he stared directly into the bear's muddy eyes. Below its cocked head, the clearing had become a target, with the scattered smudge of campfire as its bullseye. "Missed me, you hairy motherfu—" Eddie began. And then the bear, its head still cocked back to look at him, sneezed. Eddie was immediately drenched in hot snot that was filled with thousands of small white worms. They wriggled frantically on his shirt, his forearms, his throat and face. Eddie screamed in mingled surprise and revulsion. He began to brush at his eyes and mouth, lost his balance, and just managed to hook an arm around the branch beside him in time. He held on and raked at his skin, wiping off as much of the wormy phlegm as he could. The bear roared and hit the tree again. The pine rocked like a mast in a gale, but the fresh claw marks which appeared were at least 7 feet below the branch on which Eddie's feet were planted. The worms were dying, he realized, must have begun dying as soon as they left the infected swamps inside the monster's body. It made him feel a little better, and he began to climb again. He stopped 12 feet further up, daring to go no higher. The trunk of the pine, easily 8 feet in diameter at its base, was now no more than 18 inches through the middle. He had distributed his weight on 2 branches, but he could feel both of them bending springily beneath him. He had a crow's nest view of the forest and foothills to the west now, spread out below him in an undulating carpet. Under other circumstances, it would have been a view to relish. "Top of the world, Ma," he thought. He looked down into the bear's upturned face again, and for a moment all coherent thought was driven from his mind by simple amazement. There was something growing out of the bear's skull, and to Eddie it looked like a small radar dish. The gadget turned jerkily, kicking up flashes of sun as it did, and Eddie could hear it screaming thinly. He had owned a few old cars in his time, the kind that sat in the used car lots with the words Handyman Special soaked on the windshields, and he thought the sound coming from that gadget was the sound of bearings which will freeze up if they're not replaced soon. The bear uttered a long, purring growl. Yellowish foam, thick with worms, squeezed between its paws in curdled gobbets. If he had never looked into the face of utter lunacy, and he supposed he had, having been eyeball to eyeball with that world-class bitch Detta Walker on more than one occasion, Eddie was looking into it now. But that face was, thankfully, a good 30 feet below him, and at their highest reach those killing talons were 15 feet under the soles of his feet. And unlike the trees upon which the bear had vented its spleen as it approached the clearing, this one was not dead.
"Mexican standoff, honey," Eddie panted.
He wiped sweat from his forehead with one sap-sticky hand and flicked the mess down into the bugbear's face. Then the creature the old people had called Mir embraced the tree with its great forepaws and began to shake it. Eddie grabbed the trunk and held on for dear life, eyes squeezed into grim slits as the pine began to sway back and forth like a pendulum. Six. Roland halted at the edge of the clearing. Susanna, perched on his shoulder, stared unbelievingly across the open space. The creature stood at the base of the tree where Eddie had been when the two of them left the clearing 45 minutes ago. She could see only chunks and sections of its body through the screen of branches and dark green needles. Roland's other gun belt lay beside one of the monster's feet. The holster she saw was empty.
"My God!" she murmured.
The bear screamed like a distraught woman and began shaking the tree. The branches lashed as if in a high wind. Her eyes skated upward, and she saw a dark form near the top. Eddie was hugging the trunk as the tree rocked and rolled. As she watched, one of his hands slipped and flailed wildly for purchase.
"What do we do?" she screamed down at Roland. "It's gonna shake him loose! What do we do?"
Roland tried to think about it, but that queer sensation had returned again. It was always with him now, but stress seemed to make it worse. He felt like two men existing inside one skull. Each man had his own set of memories, and when they began to argue, each insisting that his memories were the true ones, the gunslinger felt as if he were being ripped in two. He made a desperate effort to reconcile these two halves, and succeeded, at least for the moment.
"It's one of the 12," he shouted. "One of the guardians. Must be. But I thought they were..."
The bear bellowed up at Eddie again. Now it began to slap at the tree like a punchy fighter. Branches snapped and fell around its feet in a tangle.
"What?" Susanna screamed. "What's the rest?"
Roland closed his eyes. Inside his head, a voice shouted, "The boy's name was Jake." Another voice shouted back, "There was no boy. There was no boy, and you know it."
"Get away, both of you," he snarled, and then called out aloud.
"Shoot it! Shoot it in the ass, Susanna! It'll turn and charge. When it does, look for something on its head. It..." The bear squalled again. It gave up slapping the tree and went back to shaking it. Ominous popping, grinding sounds were now coming from the upper part of the trunk. When he could be heard again, Roland shouted, "I think it looks like a hat, a little steel hat. Shoot it, Susanna, and don't miss!"
Terror suddenly filled her. Terror and another emotion, one she would never have expected. Crushing loneliness. "No, I'll miss. You do it, Roland."
She began to fumble his revolver out of the belt she wore, meaning to give it to him.
"Can't," Roland shouted. "The angle's bad. You have to do it, Susanna. This is the real test, and you'd better pass it."
"Roland, it means to snap the top of the tree off," he roared at her. "Can't you see that?"
She looked at the revolver in her hand, looked across the clearing at the gigantic bear obscured in the clouds and sprays of green needles, looked at Eddie swaying back and forth like a metronome. Eddie probably had Roland's other gun, but Susanna could see no way he could use it without being shaken from his perch like an overripe plum. Also, he might not shoot at the right thing. She raised the revolver. Her stomach was thick with dread.
"Hold me still, Roland," she said. "If you don't worry about me."
She fired twice, squeezing the shots as Roland had taught her. The heavy reports cut across the sound of the bear shaking the tree like the cracks of a bullwhip. She saw both bullets strike home in the left cheek of the bear's rump, less than 2 inches apart. It shrieked in surprise, pain, and outrage. One of its huge front paws came out of the dense screen of branches and needles and slapped at the hurt place. The hand came away dripping scarlet and rose back out of sight. Susanna could imagine it up there, examining its bloody palm. Then there was a rushing, rustling, snapping sound as the bear turned, bending down at the same time, dropping to all fours in order to achieve maximum speed. For the first time she saw its face, and her heart quailed. Its muzzle was lathered with foam, its huge eyes glared like lamps, its shaggy head swung to the left, back to the right, and centered upon Roland, who stood with his legs apart and Susanna Dean balanced on his shoulders. With a shattering roar, the bear charged. Seven. Say your lesson, Susanna Dean, and be true. The bear came at them in a rumbling lope. It was like watching a runaway factory machine over which someone had thrown a huge moth-eaten rug. It looks like a hat, a little steel hat. She saw it, but it didn't look like a hat to her. It looked like a radar dish, a much smaller version of the kind she had seen in movie-tone newsreel stories about how the DEW line was keeping everyone safe from a Russian sneak attack. It was bigger than the pebble she had shot off the boulder earlier, but the distance was greater. Sun and shadow ran across it in deceiving dapples. "I do not aim with my hand. She who aims with her hand has forgotten the face of her father. I can't do it. I do not shoot with my hand. She who shoots with her hand has forgotten the face of her father. I'll miss. I know I'll miss. I do not kill with my gun. She who kills with her gun..." "Shoot it!" Roland roared. "Susanna, shoot it!" With the trigger as yet unpulled, she saw the bullet go home, guided from muzzle to target by nothing more or less than her heart's fierce desire that it should fly true. All fear fell away. What was left was a feeling of deep coldness, and she had time to think, "This is what he feels. My God, how does he stand it?" "I kill with my heart, motherfucker," she said, and the gunslinger's revolver roared in her hand. 8. The silvery thing spun on a steel rod planted in the bear's skull. Susanna's bullet struck it dead center, and the radar dish blew into 100 glittering fragments. The pole itself was suddenly engulfed in a burst of crackling blue fire, which reached out in a net and seemed to grasp the sides of the bear's face for a moment. It rose on its rear legs with a whistling howl of agony, its front paws boxing aimlessly at the air. It turned in a wide, staggering circle and began to flap its arms, as if it had decided to fly away. It tried to roar again, but what came out instead was a weird warbling sound, like an air raid siren. "It is very well." Roland sounded exhausted. "A good shot, fair and true." "Should I shoot it again?" she asked uncertainly. The bear was still blundering around in its mad circle, but now its body had begun to tilt sidewards and inwards. It struck a small tree, rebounded, almost fell over, and then began to circle again. "No need," Roland said. She felt his hands grip her waist and lift her. A moment later she was sitting on the ground with her thighs folded beneath her. Eddie was slowly and shakily descending the pine, but she didn't see him. She could not take her eyes from the bear. She had seen the whales at this aquarium near Mystic, Connecticut, and believed they had been bigger than this, much bigger, probably. But this was certainly the largest land creature she had ever seen. And it was clearly dying. Its roars had become liquid bubbling sounds, and although its eyes were open, it seemed blind. It flailed aimlessly about the camp, knocking over a rack of curing hides, stamping flat the little shelter she shared with Eddie, caroming off trees. She could see the steel post rising from its head, Tendrils of smoke were rising around it, as if her shot had ignited its brains. Eddie reached the lowest branch of the tree which had saved his life and sat shakily astride it.
"Holy Mary, Mother of God," he said. "I'm looking right at it, and I still don't believe—"
The bear wheeled back toward him. Eddie leaped nimbly from the tree and streaked toward Susanna and Roland. The bear took no notice. It marched drunkenly to the pine which had been Eddie's refuge, tried to grasp it, failed, and sank to its knees. Now they could hear other sounds coming from inside it, sounds that made Eddie think of some huge truck engine stripping its gears. A spasm convulsed it, bowed its back. Its front claws rose and gored madly at its own face. Worm-infested blood flew and splattered. Then it fell over, making the ground tremble with its fall, and lay still. After all its strange centuries, the bear the old people had called Mir, the world beneath the world, was dead. Nine. Eddie picked Susanna up, held her with his sticky hands locked together at the small of her back, and kissed her deeply. He reeked of sweat and pine tar. She touched his cheeks, his neck. She ran her hands through his wet hair. She felt an insane urge to touch him everywhere until she was absolutely sure of his reality.
"It almost had me," he said. "It was like being on some crazy carnival ride. What a shot! Jesus, Suze, what a shot!"
"I hope I never have to do anything like that again," she said.
But a small voice at the center of her demurred. That voice suggested that she could not wait to do something like that again, and it was cold, that voice, cold.
"What was—" he began, turning toward Roland, but Roland was no longer standing there.
He was walking slowly toward the bear, which now lay on the ground with its shaggy knees up. From within it came a series of muffled gasps and gurgles as its strange guts continued to slowly run down. Roland saw his knife planted deep in a tree near the scarred veteran that had saved Eddie's life. He pulled it free and wiped it clean on the soft deerskin shirt which had replaced the tatters he had been wearing when the three of them had left the beach. He stood by the bear, looking down at it with an expression of pity and wonder. "Hello, stranger," he thought. "Hello, old friend. I never believed in you, not really. I believe Alain did, and I know that Cuthbert did. Cuthbert believed in everything. But I was the hard-headed one. I thought you were only a tale for children, another wind which blew around in my old nurse's hollow head before finally escaping her jabbering mouth. But you were here all along, another refugee of the old times, like the pump at the way station and the old machines under the mountains. Are the slow mutants who worship those broken remnants the final descendants of the people who once lived in this forest and finally fled your wrath? I don't know. We'll never know. But it feels right. Yes. And then I came with my friends, my deadly new friends, who are becoming so much like my deadly old friends. We came, weaving our magic circle around us and around everything we touch, strand by poisonous strand, and now here you lie at our feet. The world has moved on again, and this time, old friend, it's you who have been left behind." The monster's body still radiated a deep, sick heat. Parasites were leaving its mouth and tattered nostrils in hordes, but they died almost at once. Waxy white piles of them were growing on either side of the bear's head. Eddie approached slowly. He had shifted Susanna over to one hip, carrying her as a mother might carry a baby.
"What was it, Roland, do you know?"
"He called it a guardian, I think," Susanna said.
"Yes." Roland's voice was slow with amazement. "I thought they were all gone. Must all be gone. If they ever existed outside of the old wives' tales in the first place.
Whatever it was one crazy mother, Eddie said. Roland smiled a little. If you'd lived 2,000 or 3,000 years, you'd be one crazy mother, too.
2,000 or 3,000? Christ!
Susanna said.
Is it a bear, really? And what's that?
She was pointing at what appeared to be a square metal tag set high on one of the bear's thick rear legs. It was almost overgrown with tough tangles of hair, but the afternoon sun had pricked out a single star point of light on its stainless steel surface, revealing it. Eddie knelt and reached hesitantly toward the tag, aware that strange muffled clicks and clacks were still coming from deep inside the fallen giant. He looked at Roland.
Go ahead, the gunslinger told him. It's finished.
Eddie pushed a clump of hair aside and leaned closer. Words had been stamped into the metal. They were quite badly eroded, but he found that with a little effort he could read them. North Central Positronics Limited, Granite City, Northeast Corridor. Design 4 Guardian. Serial number AA24123CX7554312971L14. Type species bear. Shardic. NR. Subnuclear cells must not be replaced. NR.
Holy Jesus! This thing is a robot, Eddie said softly.
It can't be, Susanna said. When I shot it, it bled.
Maybe so. But your ordinary garden variety bear doesn't have a radar dish grown out of its head. And so far as I know, your ordinary garden variety bear doesn't live to be 2 or 3...
He broke off suddenly, looking at Roland. When he spoke again, his voice was revolted.
Roland, what are you doing?
Roland did not reply, did not need to reply. What he was doing, gouging out one of the bear's eyes with his knife, was perfectly obvious. The surgery was quick, neat, and precise. When it was completed, he balanced an oozing brown ball of jelly on the blade of his knife for a moment, and then flicked it aside. A few more worms made their way out of the staring hole, tried to squirm their way down the bear's muzzle, and died. The gunslinger leaned over the eye socket of Shardik, the great guardian bear, and peered inside.
Come and look, both of you, he said. I'll show you a wonder of the latter days.
Put me down, Eddie, Susanna said.
He did so, and she moved swiftly on her hands and upper thighs to where the gunslinger was hunkered down over the bear's wide, slack face. Eddie joined them, looking between their shoulders. The three of them gazed in rapt silence for nearly a full minute. The only noise came from the crows, which still circled and scolded in the sky. Blood oozed from the socket in a few thick, dying trickles. Yet it was not just blood, Eddie saw. There was also a clear fluid which gave off an identifiable scent. Bananas. And embedded in the delicate crisscross of tendons which shaped the socket, he saw a webwork of what looked like strings. Beyond them, at the back of the socket, was a red spark blinking on and off. It illuminated a tiny square board marked with silvery squiggles of what could only be solder.
It isn't a bear, it's a fucking Sony Walkman, he muttered.
Susanna looked around at him.
What?
Nothing.
Eddie glanced at Roland. Do you think it's safe to reach in? Roland shrugged.
I think so. If there was a demon in this creature, it's fled.
Eddie reached in with his little finger, nerves set to draw back if he felt even a tickle of electricity. He touched the cooling meat inside the eye socket, which was nearly the size of a baseball, and then one of those strings. Except it wasn't a string. It was a gossamer-thin strand of steel. He withdrew his finger and saw the tiny red spark blink once more before going out forever.
Shardik, Eddie murmured. I know that name. But I can't place it. Does it mean anything to you, Suze?
She shook her head.
The thing is, Eddie laughed helplessly, I associate it with rabbits. Isn't that nuts?
Roland stood up.
His knees popped like gunshots. "We'll have to move camp," he said. "The ground here is spoiled. The other clearing, the one where we go to shoot, will..." He took two trembling steps and then collapsed to his knees, palms pressed to the sides of his sagging head. 10. Eddie and Susanna exchanged a single frightened glance, and then Eddie leaped to Roland's side.
"What is it? Roland, what's wrong?"
"There was a boy," the gunslinger said in a distant, muttering voice.
And then, in the very next breath,
"There wasn't a boy."
"Roland?"
Susanna asked. She came to him, slipped an arm around his shoulders, felt him trembling.
"Roland, what is it?"
"The boy,"
Roland said, looking at her with floating, dazed eyes.
"It's the boy. Always the boy."
"What boy?" Eddie yelled frantically. "What boy?"
"Go then," Roland said. "There are other worlds than these."
And fainted. 11. That night, the three of them sat around a huge bonfire Eddie and Susanna had built in the clearing Eddie called the Shooting Gallery. It would have been a bad place to camp in the wintertime, open to the valley as it was, but for now it was fine. Eddie guessed that here in Roland's world it was still late summer. The black vault of the sky arched overhead, speckled by what seemed to be whole galaxies. Almost straight ahead, to the south, across the river of darkness that was the valley, Eddie could see Old Mother rising above the distant, unseen horizon. He glanced at Roland, who sat huddled by the fire, with three skins wrapped around his shoulders, despite the warmth of the night and the heat of the fire. There was an untouched plate of food by his side and a bone cradled in his hands. Eddie glanced back at the sky and thought of a story the gunslinger had told him and Susanna on one of the long days they had spent moving away from the beach through the foothills and finally into these deep woods where they had found a temporary refuge. "Before time began," Roland said, "Old Star and Old Mother had been young and passionate newlyweds. Then one day there had been a terrible argument. Old Mother, who in those long-ago days had been known by her real name, which was Lydia, had caught Old Star, whose real name was Apon, hanging about a beautiful young woman named Cassiopeia. They had had a real bang-up fight, those two, a hair-pulling, eye-gouging, crockery-throwing fight. One of those thrown bits of crockery had become the earth. A smaller shard, the moon, a coal from their kitchen stove had become the sun. In the end, the gods had stepped in so Apon and Lydia might not, in their anger, destroy the universe before it was fairly begun. Cassiopeia, the saucy jade who caused the trouble in the first place, yeah, right, it's always the woman, Susanna had said at this point, had been banished to a rocking chair made of stars forever and ever. Yet not even this had solved the problem. Lydia had been willing to try again, but Apon was stiff-necked and full of pride. Yeah, always blame the man, Eddie had grunted at this point. So they had parted, and now they look at each other in mingled hatred and longing from across the star-strewn wreckage of their divorce. Apon and Lydia are 3 billion years gone, the gunslinger told them. They have become Old Star and Old Mother, the North and South, each pining for the other, but both now too proud to beg for reconciliation. And Cassiopeia sits off to the side in her chair, rocking and laughing at them both. Eddie was startled by a soft touch on his arm. It was Susanna.
Come on, she said. We've got to make him talk.
Eddie carried her to the campfire and put her down carefully on Roland's right side. He sat on Roland's left. Roland looked first at Susanna, then at Eddie.
"How close you both sit to me," he remarked, "like lovers or warders in a jail."
"It's time for you to do some talking."
Susanna's voice was low, clear, and musical.
"If we're your companions, Roland, and it seems like we are, like it or not, it's time you started treating us as companions. Tell us what's wrong."
"And what we can do about it," Eddie finished.
Roland sighed deeply. "I don't know how to begin," he said. "It's been so long since I've had companions, or a tale to tell." "Start with the bear," Eddie said. Susanna leaned forward and touched the jawbone Roland held in his hands. It frightened her, but she touched it anyway.
"And finish with this."
"Yes." Roland lifted the bone to eye level and looked at it for a moment before dropping it back into his lap. "We'll have to speak of this, won't we? It's the center of the thing." But the bear came first. XII. "This is the story I was told when I was a child," Roland said. "When everything was new, the great old ones, they weren't gods, but people who had almost the knowledge of gods, created 12 guardians to stand watch at the 12 portals which lead in and out of the world. Sometimes I heard that these portals were natural things, like the constellations we see in the sky, or the bottomless crack in the earth we called Dragon's Grave because of the great burst of steam they gave off every 30 or 40 days. But other people, one I remember in particular, the head cook in my father's castle, a man named Hax, said they were not natural. That they had been created by the great old ones themselves in the days before they hanged themselves with pride like a noose and disappeared from the earth. Hax used to say that the creation of the 12 guardians was the last act of the great old ones, their attempt to atone for the great wrongs they had done to each other and to the earth itself.
Portals, Eddie mused. Doors, you mean? Well, back to those again. Do these doors that lead in and out of the world open on the world Susan and I came from, like the ones we found along the beach?
I don't know, Roland said. For everything I do know, there are 100 things I don't. You, both of you, will have to reconcile yourselves to that fact. The world has moved on, we say. When it did, it went like a great receding wave, leaving only wreckage behind. Wreckage that sometimes looks like a map.
Well, make a guess, Eddie exclaimed, and the raw eagerness in his voice told the gunslinger that Eddie had not given up the idea of returning to his own world and Susanna's even now, not entirely.
Leave him be, Eddie, Susanna said. The man don't guess.
Not true. Sometimes the man does, Roland said, surprising them both. When guessing's the only thing left, sometimes he does. The answer is no. I don't think, I don't guess, that these portals are much like the doors on the beach. I don't guess they go to a where or when that we would recognize. I think the doors on the beach, the ones that led into the world you both came from, were like the pivot at the center of a child's teeter board. Do you know what that is?
Seesaw?
Susanna asked and tipped her hand back and forth to demonstrate.
Yes, Roland agreed, looking pleased, just so. On one end of this saucy
seesaw,
Eddie said, smiling a little. Yes, on one end, my car. On the other, that of the man in black, Walter. The doors were the center, creations of the tension between two opposing destinies. These other portals are things far greater than Walter or me or the little fellowship we three have made.
Are you saying, Susanna asked hesitantly, that the portals where these guardians stand watch are outside Ka, beyond Ka?
I'm saying that I believe so. He offered his own brief smile, a thin sickle in the firelight. That I guess so. He was silent a moment, then he picked up a stick of his own. He brushed away the carpet of pine needles and used the stick to draw in the dirt beneath. Here is the world as I was told it existed when I was a child. The X's are the portals standing in a ring at its eternal edge. If one drew 6 lines connecting these portals in pairs, so... He looked up, Do you see where the lines cross in the center? Eddie felt goose flesh crawl up his back and down his arms. His mouth was suddenly dry.
Is that it, Roland? Is that...
Roland nodded. His long, lined face was grave. At this nexus lies the Great Portal, the so-called 13th Gate, which rules not just this world, but all worlds. He tapped the center of the circle. Here is the Dark Tower for which I've searched my whole life.